And to see, you know, two very hardened men who may have been a part of the drug world for, you know, decades, or a young man who is, you know, kind of a cholo, a tough kid, having to wash the feet of an elder is very humbling.
Welcome to Bridging the Bones, a podcast exploring the causes, context, and potential solutions to conflict. I'm Sotaline Wang. It's not really a secret. I mean, the fact that drug rehabilitation and mental care systems in many countries took a dive during the COVID-19 pandemic years and are barely recovering now. Even in supposedly wealthy societies, we have witnessed some notable failures in providing help to those who most need it. What if your government lacks the money or just doesn't care? Or what if there just aren't enough trained therapists in the healthcare pipeline? Joining me today is our guest and guide, Dr. Angela Garcia, author of The Way That Leads Among the Lost, Life, Death, and Hope in Mexico City's Anexos, published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. She is a professor at Stanford University's Department of Anthropology. She conducted a long-term study of the phenomena of poor and working class people creating a hidden system of care, something known as Anexos. Brace yourselves. This dive down the rabbit hole will include some discussion of verbal and physical abuse. So, what is an Anexo?
Anexos are, simply put, unregulated, uncertified spaces of addiction treatment and treatment for mental illness that are widely utilized by Mexico's working poor, people without access to professional treatment. And they are an anexo, literally is an annex. So these are small spaces, usually one-bedroom apartments or a space within a larger multifamily, dwelling. And they there are people that are essentially interned in them. They are brought to Anexos against their wills, usually by family members. And they're committed anywhere from 3 days to 3 years. In fact, I've met people who are committed to Anexos who've been in the same room, and they're generally one room where, 30 to 40 people live that have been in this room for up to 7 years. And families take their loved ones to these places because they're at risk of addiction. They have mental health issues that the family can no longer address, or because the family member is at risk of the deadly violence that is intensifying in, particularly in low-income neighborhoods in Mexico City. And so these spaces I describe in the book, both as places of care and treatment, although that treatment is ambiguous, given that it draws on practices of psychological and physical violence as a mode of treatment. They're spaces of treatment, but they're also spaces of confinement, and they have a prison-like quality to them. And families choose these places with, a great deal of reservation. But they find that they have no better option to keep their relatives, often young people, young men and young women, safe from the violence that surrounds their communities. They're for-profit. Families pay a small fee every month to keep their family members interned. And they form a really large basis of treatment in Mexico more broadly. Approximately 90% of all treatment for addiction and mental illness takes place in these kinds of settings.
Wow, 90%? That's,
yeah.
That's, I thought Mexico has a healthcare system that
deals
deals with some of this.
It does, but only less than 2% of the healthcare budget is earmarked for mental health conditions and substance abuse. So a very small amount of money goes into these conditions, and most of the money that is earmarked for mental health issues, including substance abuse, goes to psychiatric hospitals, state-run psychiatric hospitals. So there are very few resources, and particularly in rural areas, underfunded areas, Anexos have become the primary source of treatment for addiction and mental illness.
Now, I mean, you say that, at the same time, I think, didn't most of your research take place in the Capitol?
It did. I did spend time outside of the Capitol, considerable amount of time in Ecatepec, which is essentially parallel. It's adjacent to Mexico City, and it's a space where there is the highest rate of femicide in the country is unfolding in Ecatepec. So right outside of the border of Mexico City. I spent time in Anexos in Oaxaca, Chihuahua, Tijuana, and Anexos in the United States as well, where there are Mexican communities. There often are these places too, because there's a long tradition now going back, stretching back to the early 90s, where Anexos have become a really important source of treatment and care and protection for at-risk families. And so they extend far beyond Mexico City and even reach as deep into the United States as well. There's a saying in Spanish, you know, donde hay Mexicanos, hay Anexos. Where there are Mexicans, there are Anexos. And I have found that to be true throughout Mexico, but also in the United States as well.
So it sounds like Anexos are sort of an intentional institutional export of Mexico at this point.
Yeah, you know, it builds off a tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is really extensive throughout Mexico. I would say AA is one of the leading treatment sort of regimes that Mexico has to offer. And Anexos emerge out of this tradition when in the early 90s, one of the founders of a group realized, you know what, we don't have places for marginally housed people to live during treatment. And so they started creating essentially these rooms where people could go and live and do it like an inpatient treatment program. And over the years, these places, one of the focuses of my study has been why they have adopted certain kinds of treatment practices that seem to mimic some of the more troubling practices that we see criminal organizations utilizing, such as kidnapping, such as really like terrible, violent, coercive practices of. So I became interested in, you know, how could this place, which is ostensibly a place where people care for each other and provide the kinds of services that otherwise would be unavailable, why and how are they engaging in these practices that are precisely the ones that families seek to protect their family, you know, their relatives from? Because so many of the people that I have interviewed, and I've interviewed well over 100 people who have been in and out of these spaces, you know, have said to me, I wasn't there necessarily because I have a drug problem. I was there because I was engaged in the drug world, or I was at risk of the, you know, drug-related violence. And so my family took me and put me in this place in order to protect me from, you know, the violence in my neighborhood. So they serve a multiplicity of, you know, different needs.
So you mentioned violence within the Anexos earlier. Given that you were an observer in a lot of different Anexos, in these confined in that they were overcrowded, right? What kinds of violence are we talking about?
Well, there's the violence of entry, which is occurs through a kidnapping. So people, unbeknownst to them and against them, their will, are usually taken in the middle of the night. And they are, a hood is thrown over their head so they can't see. They're often bound and they are thrown into a car. They're driven around. They don't know where they're going. And they're usually, in the interviews that I've done with people who've experienced this, say, I thought I was going to be killed. I thought I was going to be disappeared. But instead, I was thrown into this annexo. And that modality is meant, specifically intended to instill fear, to make the person, to make the anexado fear for their life, only to be then later revealed that they haven't been killed, they haven't been kidnapped. Instead, there's someone in their family that loves them deeply, that wants them to be cared for, and wants them to be safe, and so has sent them into this place. But the first act of getting there is a very, very traumatic act. Once they're in these spaces, in some annexos, I studied dozens of them, but not certainly, I mean, there are thousands of them, so I can't say that they're all alike. But the ones that I studied, in a few of them, heads are shaved upon arrival. People can be chained to walls. People have to maintain strict bodily comportment. There's a lot of kneeling on knees during the day, during various kinds of physical exercise. There's very strict schedules. There's a form of counseling that seems very psychologically abusive, where people are made to sort of sink into the wretchedness of their life and to really dwell there over extended periods of time. I mean, one testimony or confession could last all night. And not only is the person who's doing the testimony, giving the testimony or the confession, made under the threat of violence to keep going, but the people that are in the audience, the other anexados, are forced to sit in very uniform ways. And if they begin to slouch or fall asleep or something of that nature, they'll be smacked, they'll be hit with a cane, they'll be derided. And so these are the kinds of everyday practices that coexist alongside things like Bible study, coexist along things like, what they call yoga, which is, stretching and running in circles, because these are usually one room where, and they are small, they're relatively small, one room where, 30 to 40 people live day after day. There's no furniture. Or everything is collapsible so it can be moved throughout the day to make room for certain activities. People are sleeping on the floor. They're eating, they make out of, vegetables and lentils that mothers usually donate. And often it's not the best quality food. And often it may only be one meal a day, but it's a meal. And that meal is important. And there's a lot of sharing that occurs in off times where people talk about their lives. And I think it's through the kind of community that annexos actually do, engender, that people begin to experience something like recovery. It's through, the constant demand to talk and to talk about one's life, where people begin to do some form of reflection that can open up the possibility for some form of healing.
You did mention, let's backtrack a little bit. You did say something about that only 2% of Mexico's healthcare budget is used for psychiatric treatment. But does that include all mental illness? Is all drug addiction part of that 2%, or do they have like a partially separate budget for other kinds of drug addiction, alcohol addiction treatment?
Right now, with the new administration, there is, so far it's been in word only, but a desire to create a more robust treatment system for addiction, per se. but that has not been realized. And, you know, there are, for example, in Mexico City, which is a megalopolis of over 13 million people, less than 100 registered professional treatment programs, residential inpatient treatment programs that are run by professional healthcare workers, contrasted to approximately what is estimated around 7,000 annexos. So there's a real disparity in terms of what is available for people, and people that don't have access to professional healthcare. There are many, many treatment programs for people who can afford to pay for them. But, right. You know, over 50% of Mexico's population are informal working poor people who work in the informal sector and who live, you know, paycheck to paycheck, day to day. And it's those people that Annexos really serves. And it's those people, too, that create these spaces. Most of the people that work in Annexos had been in them as sort of like patients, and then they would go on to become counselors in these spaces and then eventually open up one of their own. And so they've proliferated dramatically across Mexico City, but also across the country.
So it sounds like one of the reasons that they proliferate is because the people who are committed inside them sometimes develop their understanding or get enough reputation or enough knowledge of how they work to start their own annexos several years later.
That's right. And it's in some ways parallel to what we see in the United States with drug counselors, who are often people who have struggled with drug problems themselves. They get involved in drug treatment. They find themselves inspired by, you know, the drug counselors that have helped them. They go to school, get a, you know, 2-year certificate, and come out and then become drug counselors. And Annexos operate in a similar way, where they're called anexados, those that are interned or those that are annexed. They may stay for many years, may eventually their position within the annexo may change, and they may become a counselor, and then eventually will be deemed, you know, recovered in some sense, although the notion of what that is remains ambiguous to me. What recovery means in this context is a little unclear. But nevertheless, many people that I knew who are once anexados move on to become counselors and then move on to become what are called padrinos or madrinas, godfathers or godmothers or sponsors, who then go on to open their own such place. Often in the very dwellings, the multifamily dwellings that they live in, they'll rent out, for example, a one-bedroom apartment or a one-room apartment, and use that as an annexo. And everyone in the building knows that these places exist. They're aware of them. They make use of them at times. And they just, you know, they exist alongside, you know, the broader community in full knowledge of, with the full knowledge of what these places actually, you know, are engaged in. And like I said, a lot of what they engage in are practices of physical and psychological violence, but always with the aim of some kind of cure. And the use of violence in the setting of addiction is not new. It's not specific to Mexico. I mean, we could think of like boot camps for teenagers in the United States, where kids with drug problems are violently kidnapped from their home, taken to a place in like Utah or Montana or New Mexico, and are made to live very difficult lives for, you know, 30 days to 6 months. And so in a sense, these are quite different, but they share a fundamental philosophy wherein struggle, be that both personal and physical struggle, is seen as an avenue toward healing.
This is Bridging the Bones, your podcast about the context and consequences of conflict. We're in conversation with Professor Angela Garcia on her book, The Way That Leads Among the Lost. We will return after a brief break. As you can guess, it's a bit difficult to find commercial endorsements for this kind of program. So this is kind of where we need you, dear listener, to step in, keeping us on the air as we deliver unconventional ideas and critically important questions to you. Sign up for our email list and, if you can, consider becoming a monthly or annual subscriber. As a subscriber, you get access to bonus content with over 40 more minutes of analysis and revelation from this interview alone. Go to our website, bridgingthebones.fyi. Click subscribe to find out. This is Bridging the Bones, a podcast exploring the causes, context, and potential solutions to conflict. Welcome back to our interview with Dr. Angela Garcia. She helps us understand how Mexico became the seabed for the formation of Anexos.
Mexico's history with illicit drugs goes back a long way. I think a lot of people listening to this are probably shocked by the levels of drug violence in Mexico. And what is that context really about? Like, just taking, for instance, the drug war, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think you note that Mexico has been dealing with this since like at least the 1920s.
Right.
And under the Partido, was it the Institutional Revolutionary Party or something?
Yeah.
Which is very funny irony.
Yes, it was a terrible irony. I mean, there have been points, really. I mean, you point to the 1920s. There have been many operations, U.S.-funded operations, to try to deal with, you know, the growth of opium in Mexico, you know, eradication campaigns that, you know, usually against poor farmers who have no other choice but to grow the drug. And one of the, I think, key moments in the expansion of the drug problem in Mexico was the passage of NAFTA, because we saw with the passage of NAFTA many people losing their agricultural, you know, foothold in their lands, many people having to leave the rural countryside and move to the cities, begin working in what are called maquiladoras, these very large plants where products are assembled, usually for an American consumer, but are assembled in the United States. Very low-paying jobs where there are, you know, documented abuses, particularly against women who form the majority of people working in this industry. And so NAFTA really transformed the Mexican economy, and it pushed a lot of people who were displaced from their, you know, former lives as farm workers into, you know, either the maquila economy or into the economy of illicit drug, you know, dealing or growing or smuggling. And so we see farmers who once grew corn suddenly growing opium. And they're doing so under the duress of criminal organizations, often with ties to the Mexican government, doing so because they have no other option. There are no other jobs. And so NAFTA has been pointed by many scholars as really being key to understanding the transformation of Mexico's drug economy. And so we are very much embedded in the story of Mexico's drug economy. We are, you know, the largest consumer of the drugs that flow through Mexico, that are produced in Mexico. We consume these drugs, and at the same time, we have eradication campaigns to get rid of these drugs, which are essentially target poor, marginalized rural communities that have no other choice but then to be in this drug economy in order to provide for themselves and their families. So Mexican people are very much caught in a kind of catch-22 situation. they would much rather be, you know, growing things that they could, you know, corn, squash, the foods that have fed, you know, Mexican people for millennia. But instead, with these sort of policy, global geopolitical policy changes, have found themselves really in a situation where there are very few opportunities. And one opportunity that does exist, where one can make a living, is to participate in these growing drug economies. So everyone from, you know, I've met, you know, grandmothers who are engaged in small scale drug dealing in their communities as a means to provide for their grandchildren. So we basically have a situation where people without a lot of opportunity find themselves encumbered in the drug world, but in the context where there are, again, very few opportunities for anything, any other formal forms of employment. The drug economy is a complicated one. It's one that's not all sort of these high-profile cartel narcos that we see on television and in films, or that are paraded around, you know, following arrest or execution. You know, we're talking about low-level drug dealers who sustain drug economies within communities and do so, you know, with considerable discomfort, because they recognize that they're also contributing to the problem of drug addiction within their communities. And so Anexos really kind of emerged from this environment. You know, the first Anexo can be traced to 1992, when Mexico was in a terrible debt crisis, and the status of people, the economic status of the majority of Mexicans plummeted. And Anexos fit into this economy, but in complicated ways, because it is a space where, you know, people do have to pay to put their loved ones in these places. So a lot of the people that run Anexos talked to me about how these places do emerge from this tradition of mutual aid. And I can very much see that, I could see that, you know, very much present in the discourse and in the practices and in the beliefs that people had about Anexos. At the same time, I saw these emergent practices of violence that reflected the world that exists beyond the Anexos walls. And my book is an attempt to try to understand them, you know, within a historical context, but also to understand them within really the present day situation that Mexico is faced with, where there are fewer and fewer protections for the poor. And they're filling a healthcare void, and they're filling a void of, you know, people not feeling protected by the services that are meant to protect them, including the police, who are actually seen as more perpetrators than anything else.
Right. Let me just interrupt you for a second. I mean, I think a lot of people who have been to Mexico are aware of the widespread corruption amongst the police. But from what your book was saying, I remember reading somewhere where when you initially try to begin doing research on Anexos, you actually met up with some, well, first of all, a lot of government people in the capital, in the Distrito Federal, the federal district, they simply either didn't want to talk to you, mm-hmm. or one of them even, I believe she was an epidemiologist,
yes,
somebody who studies epidemics, she actually said, quote, garbage cans are for trash. I mean, I'm sure she said this in Spanish, and she was saying that in reference to Anexos. And
right.
So it sounds like the government just doesn't even recognize Anexos as part of its healthcare system.
Definitely
at
not.
All.
No, they don't. And there have been campaigns to close them. There have been campaigns also to regularize them or to give them some kind of certification, because they do not conform to you know, the norms of what a residential treatment program should be like. So there have been attempts at various points to get Anexos certified. But the forms of certification that Anexos are meant to sort of embrace are things that are fundamentally opposed to the values and the needs that people who rely on Anexos have. For example, one of the requirements is maintaining patient records. Many of the people who run Anexos and who utilize them have third grade education levels, if that. Another requirement is that there are bathrooms for both men and women. Most Anexos I visited, you know, have to use a shared bathroom in a courtyard that's shared with other people living in the building. There are requirements for how much space, a limit on the number of people that could be treated in Anexos at any given time. There's such a tremendous need for these places that the padrinos and madrinas, the people that direct these places, said, you know what, certification, which would come with a small government grant, does not serve the needs of my community. It makes it impossible for me to take in the people that need my services. And frankly, it's, you know, these bureaucratic reforms are not the reforms that, you know, this community seeks to instantiate. What they want, if anything, is simply the right to exist and to not be continually harassed by the police, to not be continually bribed by the police. If you want to stay open, you have to pay me this amount of money every month, which is very common in Mexico, having to pay to remain open if you are an illegal business. Yeah, there's a real gap in care, and Anexos are really an effort to close that gap. But they close the gap in a way that is certainly ethically very confusing, complicated. There's a chapter in my book called The Gray Zone where I'm wrestling with what are these places actually doing to people? You know, the driving force behind Anexos, I came to understand, are mothers, mothers with children who are at risk of violence, mothers of, you know, with children who have been disappeared or killed, who don't want their other children to be disappeared or killed, who send their kids to these places at a great expense to them and with a lot of moral suffering, but they send them there because they want to know their kids can be locatable, that they're safe, that they're being fed, that they have a roof, and that they're doing some kind of psychological work in order to sort of address profound, you know, psychological stress, PTSD, of depression, of anxiety, you know, these increasing conditions that can really be traced to the exacerbation of violence that has occurred really since 2012 when the drug war officially began.
Now, you mentioned that Anexos grew out of the Alcoholics Anonymous movement in the 70s. And so do you feel like they're structured in a way that's heavily influenced by contemporary working people's views of Christianity? And I'm assuming Protestantism, right? Because AA grew out of Protestant Christianity to a large degree.
Well, this is, I think, the interesting thing about AA in Mexico is it's overwhelmingly Catholic in orientation. And Anexos are overwhelmingly Catholic. I mean, saints, crosses, Jesus, you know, is ever present in iconography on the walls, in, you know, the prayers that people are forced to make. So they are very culturally specific form of AA, and they do subscribe to 12-step practices, but they focus primarily on steps 4 and steps 5, which both of which are very much in line with, you know, admitting your wrongdoings, step 4, and confessing to those who you have wronged, step 5. And Nexos practiced step four and step five more than any other step in the 12 steps.
You note that, I mean, that there is a lot of Catholic themes and there's a lot of Catholic imagery, like there's a lot of like paintings or like small sculptures of like Jesus being nailed to the wall, or, you know, but especially like gory depictions.
Yeah. The ethos is very much one of suffering. And a lot of the forms of what we might look at as merely violence are meant to inculcate like a suffering subject, a suffering person. People are suffering. And within an exos, you are reminded that you are suffering. You are made to suffer, but you are made to suffer in order to achieve a certain kind of self-realization or a certain kind of community. And that's not unlike, you know, I come from New Mexico. I was born and raised in New Mexico, and there's a tradition among Catholics in New Mexico called the penitentes, the penitents. And this is a longstanding brotherhood where, you know, very religious Catholic men, it's a brotherhood, would engage in things like self-flagellation. They would engage in various forms of bodily mortification as an expression of their faith.
And I mean, you mentioned the use of like self-criticism of hours-long confessions. I think they also refer to it as testimonies or testimonios. But they also do things that like come out of the Bible, like washing each other's feet.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, there are various forms of like intimacy that do stem from biblical practice. And to see, you know, two very hardened men who may have been a part of the drug world for, you know, decades, or a young man who is, you know, kind of a cholo, a tough kid, having to wash the feet of an elder is very humbling. Or to have his feet washed. You know, I observed this, and it's a very humbling position to be in, but it's also very emotionally, you know, powerful. I mean, I grew up Catholic, and I, you know, so a lot of this wasn't entirely new to me. And I could see these gestures of faith and of humanity within these spaces that have been widely condemned as abusive, as unethical, as hell holes, you know, as garbage cans for trash, as the epidemiologist said. But within these spaces are these acts of care that do have a sort of solid religious basis, Catholic basis, that is very strong. And to be honest, I mean, very, very moving to observe. You're literally touching the body of others and trying to get that body to experience itself in new ways. And so there are cathartic moments in these places that are otherwise really grim and really very, very difficult. But the practices, even those that involve violence, are intended to create these moments of rupture, of transformation, and of self-realization. And so it's very powerful, and it took me, I mean, I spent 10 years studying this community because it was so initially disorienting for me to understand what was going on. But with sort of slow, careful observation, you know, over the course of, you know, a decade, I began to see, you know, these as places that are far more than spaces of torture, spaces where people are, you know, disposable people are thrown. They're much more than that.
I'd like to step back for a second. I feel like there's a aspect of this that we haven't talked about. An exos being, they're sort of safe houses, right? They're sort of refuges from certain aspects of the wider violent life, and they're sort of invisible. I think we've established that. So how in the world did you as a person with a graduate degree from the United States, albeit being Latina yourself, but how did you even get access to these spaces?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had come to Mexico City really fleeing my first research project, my first book, The Pastoral Clinic, which is about intergenerational heroin addiction in New Mexico. And I wanted, and I grew up in that environment, and I wanted to escape drugs. I wanted to get away from issues of family violence. And I went to Mexico City to study something entirely different, which has nothing to do with what I ended up ultimately studying. And I met a man who was actually someone who I called upon to drive me places for the study that I was doing at the time, the unrelated study. And he asked me one day, you know, what are you doing? Why do you always go to this random place in, you know, the south of Mexico City? And I told him what I was studying, and he had no response. And then I said to him, well, in my previous work, I worked with families struggling with addiction problems. And he opened up a conversation with me and told me that his daughter was in an annexo. And I didn't know what that meant. And so he described them to me. And they recalled the clinic that I had worked at in New Mexico to a certain extent. And I became kind of fascinated by the presence of these places, because he said to me, you know, what you want to study is never going to materialize, but annexos are everywhere. And when he said annexos are everywhere, I just like held on to that. And it was in my mind for months before I made the decision to call him and say, look, is there any way you can get me into one of these places? And he said to me, you know, it's not a good idea. You don't belong in these places. They're not safe. And I said, will you accompany me? And he accompanied me to an annexo that was run by a man he knew. And once I got into one and sort of won the favor of the director, I was introduced to another and then to another and to another. So it was all word of mouth. And ultimately, you know, and I'm glad that it sort of snowballed that way, because I trusted the director of the first annexo that I visited.
This would be Padrino Julio, right?
He was the second one, Padrino okay. Francisco. So they made sure the padrinos that kind of looked after me while I was doing this research made sure that the annexos that I was studying were relatively stable places that didn't engage in some really extreme practices that other annexos are known to engage in. So I was in a relatively safe, I was safeguarded from some of the darker aspects of annexos that have been written about in newspapers. And I found myself in just, you know, once I scratched the surface, I found that there were just so many of them. And I, of course, I couldn't study all of them, but I studied, you know, about 20 over the course of 10 years and got to know the people in them very well. Got to know the anexados well, although sometimes I would return for field work and they would be gone and no one would know where they went. So I couldn't follow up. The people that were sort of the most consistent people in my study were actually the mothers who put their children in annexos. And I was very interested in their stories. Like, what does it mean to be a mother who strives to care and protect her child, but does so through these places that are known to inflict violence and abuse? And what kind of terrible ethical wager must that mother go through? And so I became really interested in the stories of mothers. And there's one mother that I follow throughout the book. Her name is Hortensia. And I follow kind of her logic as to why she put her son, Daniel, into one of these places. Ultimately, it did not end up well for Daniel. And Hortensia ended up raising his child. So it's a complicated family story. But what became very interesting to me was the way that women really, in some ways, sustain these places through their labor, through their contributions, and through the donation, quote unquote, donations that they're made to give every month to keep their kids inside. working extra shifts as a laundry worker in order to pay for the Anexos fees, which are always couched in the language of a contribution, just like they are in church, a tithe. But in fact, if you don't pay, you're kicked out.
Well, and it sounds like, to a certain degree, you were jumped into the Anexo research. Not that you were forced into it, like you weren't kidnapped, of course, but that just to get into the Anexo, you were kind of barraged with very, very personal questions. Some of the questions and statements that Padrino Julio directed at you were kind of like being on a witness stand, and you have this lawyer who's trying to discredit you, who's trying to get into your head. Like it sounds like there's a lot of that, but it brings up the subject of desagüe, which that you mentioned in the book. This I think that's that you defined it as draining, right?
Like right.
Literally means to unwater,
right?
Or something very similar to unwater somebody. I think some of the therapists or the psychologists in our audience would want to hear more about that. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, desagüe is a form of coercive confession where an anexado is made to stand in or sit in front of their peers, and they are interrogated by a counselor and made to say all of the terrible things that they've done and all of the terrible things that have been done to them. Things that often include like sexual violence, criminal violence, family violence. There's a lot of violence involved in these narratives. That's the central theme. And they are meant to go to sort of let it all out, basically, over the course of many, many hours. And so it's exhausting. It's exhausting to observe. I'm sure it's exhausting to undergo. And the audience is very much called into the narrative. The counselor will ask questions, how do you feel about so-and-so? Do you want them? Do you desire them? And the anexado who's giving the testimony or the confession, who's being drained, literally drained of all energy, will respond very carefully because they don't want to stir up resentments or problems with the people that they have to live with. So it's really, it's a form of discourse that is interactive, but it is like the counselor becomes like the priest, and the anexado who's giving the testimony is like the confessant, and they are made to go through the darkest stories of their life. They have to tell these very dark stories about themselves and about the people that they love and that have hurt them and who they've hurt. And at the end of this, there's a kind of collapse that occurs, and the anexado is literally drained of all of their energy. And they usually do collapse. And after the collapse, usually one or two anexados will come and comfort them and bring them to the table or to the audience. And then the very next day, someone else will go through this process. So it's really the rhythm of everyday life in Anexos are these practices of testimony or the desagüe. They call them different things. Anexos have different terms for them. But this one particular draining session that I describe, they use the notion of desagüe. And I read into it that there is a kind of catharsis that does emerge from this practice. And so I saw in it a very, it's painful to watch. I mean, I was crying much of the time, and it was very difficult to figure out what my role should have been as an observer in this context. But I did what everyone else did. I sat back and I sat straight, because you have to sit very straight and you have to have both feet on the floor in a particular way and your hands have to be on your knees. And I sat the way everyone else did, and I just took it in. And so I experienced sort of my own version of catharsis during this process. But, it's it's grueling. And there are, in fact, on YouTube, some videos of these rituals that have been posted from an exos that you can observe. You know, it might seem cultish or weird, but I think they're very effective in drawing together a sense of community, and they're certainly effective in breaking people down. But the point of the breakdown isn't, you're not left alone at that point. You're embraced back into the community. And so in that sense, it's very much a cathartic ritual.
Not to get too, you know, into the stratosphere of ivory tower language, but the point is, I do want to ask you about this person that you quote a few times. I believe his name is Jean-Luc Nancy.
Yes.
Well, and I mentioned Jean-Luc Nancy because I feel like I had to pause and reread some of this several times, because it seems like there's an aspect of what you were quoting that speaks to the desagüe process, especially the diswatering process, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's page 92, where you're quoting him. "Isn't the philosopher someone who always hears, but who cannot listen?"
Right.
"Who neutralizes listening within himself so that he can philosophize? Question mark." And then he goes on to talk about the penetration of the self and some abstruse stuff about self and other and in interior, exterior. And thinking about the desagüe process, right, which was, you know, just to summarize, was a process of self-disclosure to a point of exhaustion that was also, like, as we covered, somewhat potentially theatrical, mm-hmm, and performative, but not in the way that we typically think of, right? Like today in the 21st century, it's 2026, you know, people disclose a lot on social,
right,
media, or they have. I don't know if that's still popular at this current moment in our strange history of persecution. But during the heyday of social media, people disclosed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Right? People talked about themselves a lot. Some of which was embarrassing. Some of which was, you know, supposed to be inspiring, whatnot. But the desagüe process is altogether different from that in certain ways. That's Jean-Luc Nancy was speaking to something that doesn't really occur, or a lot less, in terms of how people testify on social media versus what people were doing within these enclosed, more intimate spaces of the an exo.
Yes.
Could you speak on that for a second?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that Jean-Luc Nancy talks about in that quote, he's interested in modes of listening. How do we listen to each other? And he's not interested in the transfer of information. And I think a lot of what we see in social media is, I was here, I went there, I did this, look at me. You know, that kind of performative self-disclosure that really doesn't, it's not anchored in anything that has depth, and it doesn't necessarily reach the viewer in a way that is emotionally, affectively, intersubjectively, you know, with depth. And the desagüe is a mode of communication, I think, where the person who is doing the disclosure is really, you know, Nancy used the word penetrate. You are penetrated by what the person is speaking. And you are listening on another register. You're listening not only with your ears, but your entire body becomes like vulnerable to what the other person, the person who is giving testimony or confessing, is saying. You're enveloped in their story. And that's the quality of listening that Nancy is very interested in, and was lamenting that that quality of listening is becoming more and more rare. And I think that this is where the ethics of Anexos lie. It's not that they're quote unquote unethical because they kidnap people and hold them against their will. They're ethical precisely because they create this, the, you know, space where people are able to grieve, to reflect, you know, openly and with such rawness. And people who are, yes, they're forced to listen, but they listen, and they're listening with their entire being. And they're not just listening, but they're relating, they're understanding, they've been there themselves. And so there's a reflection that also is occurring. And it's, you know, it's deeply moving. And, you know, I was shaken by it when I left the first Isawe. I observed, and I write about this in the book, I left the room and I collapsed into the arms of the one of the women that ran the Anexo. And I just like collapsed into her arms. It would have been like a 6-hour confession. And I was so, I had never experienced anything like that in my life. And to know that that happened every single day, it forces a kind of opening of the self in order to receive the other. Now, that said, there are some people there that like could very clearly tune it out. But most people would be opened to the stories, to the feeling, to the history of the speaking subject. And they related to it, they accepted it, they received it, and they were truly moved by it. And that creates a kind of community that I think is very rare today, and very precious. And I found it in the strangest of places, you know, the most unexpected place. I never would have expected to have that revealed to me, you know, in that way, in that place. And I'm trying to find within these spaces, you know, well, the word hope is in the title of the book. And I do find within these spaces glimmers of hope from time to time. And maybe that's me just like needing it for myself. But I know that, you know, after 10 years of studying these communities, that mothers and those that are within Anexos also have hope of some form for themselves, for their family, you know, for their future.
Well, thank you very much for speaking
with
us, Angela.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
You've just heard our interview with anthropology professor Angela Garcia about her book, The Way That Leads Among the Lost, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Bridging the Bones is an independent podcast free of influence from Fortune 500 companies, governments, or political parties. You can find more episodes of this podcast on our website, bridgingthebones.fyi, or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks this week to Alexei Chistilin for use of the audio track, Dark Carnival. This is your host, Sertoline Wang, signing off.